Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. This is Arnie Luke's here at the Crossroads, and I'd like to welcome a new guest from Texas. Welcome, Mark Anderson.
Great to be here, Arnie.
No worries. Pleased to have you. What's the weather like in Texas, Mark?
Fahrenheit, it's about 75 to 80 degrees, fairly breezy because I'm near the Gulf of Mexico.
Okay, cool. All right. Well, we're probably receiving similar weather here in Adelaide. I'd like to continue welcoming our guest, Wallace Klink from Canada. Welcome, Wallace.
Oh, hi, Arnie. Nice to be with you again and with the new group.
No worries.
Arnie,
How's your weather, Wally?
it's pretty decent. It's pretty decent. It's around the 0 point or even melting a bit.
Okay, beautiful, beautiful. And finally, Robert Klink. Welcome, Robert.
Good to be here, Arnie.
No worries.
Minus 25 last night, minus 30 with the wind factor.
Oh
Pretty brutal on this side of the country.
well. Yeah, that's incredible, the variability, because we're roughly plus 30 maximum today, centigrade, and there you are, look at minus 30. It's just but this is adaptation. This is what people do, and it's very interesting that we're able to accommodate such variability in the climate. Okay, today's topic, Paradise Denied. It's an interesting subject because the in a land of milk and honey, in a land of plenty, where we have so much productive capacity, we have so many availabilities, if you like, of raw materials, of technology, of innovation, of creativeness, and here we are. Homelessness rampant right throughout each country, each state is experiencing it. I know in Australia we have politicians who are actually banging the doors because of the situation. Here we have plenty, and yet there's rampant poverty. It is so wrong, and this opens the if you like, our subject, Paradise Denied. Mark Anderson, you've got the floor.
Yeah, it's a predicament that we're in, a very ongoing predicament that's completely avoidable. As you said, Arnie, everything's available to create a wonderful life, economically, spiritually, politically, and across the board. And the key thing to remember is that what we're never going to solve our political problems unless we first solve this economic and monetary dilemma. Because the governments and the people are both trapped within the monetary monopoly, the monopoly of credit, excuse me. And as long as we're within that illicit framework, we can keep switching politicians, we can keep electing new presidents and new members of parliament and Congress, but ultimately paradise will be denied because we're not confronting the monopoly of credit and changing the framework within which governments and individuals operate. So we have to make that change. That is the thing that we cannot lose sight of.
No, that's a very, very important opening salvo that you're identifying, that the core problem, the root of the problem, is monetary policy. It's actually central banking, and it's if you like, it's the monopoly of credit, that governments go cap in hand to release the productive capacity of the nation to private banks, privately owned institutions. Your thoughts, Wally Klink.
Yes, that's true. And when we say paradise, we're not talking about some abstract conception to be applied to everyone. We're talking about a society of abundance wherein individuals are free to seek their own ends and to make their own paradise, if you want, in quotes. And that's the type of society that social credit is trying to effect or make possible. So, it is based on individual freedom, and we want to make that very, very clear. Douglass was quite critical of the idea of utopianism. In other words, the utopianist who has some kind of a concept in his mind of how the world should function, and he wants to impose that particular social and economic structure on other people. That's not what we're talking about at all. So we want to be very clear about that.
Yeah, no, that's a very, very good point, Wallace. I noticed that you mentioned an imposition of someone else's point of view over other people, and that to me is quite profound, as if power A utopianist wants to exercise power over others, whereas a stable, cohesive society is about power being exercised by the individual, freedom of choice. And of course, that is the function of government, is to provide the environment for the individuals to make those freedoms of choice. Your thoughts, Robert Klink?
Well, people have short memories, unfortunately, and the young people, at least, are always convinced that the experience they're having is normal. But in fact, if you look at history, there have been periods when people were, in some ways at least, substantially better off than we are today. In the Middle Ages, there was the phenomenon of what is known as Merry England. And in that period of time, there was something like 100 days of religious festivals every year. And on religious festivals, people were not allowed to work. Now, this might have been some kind of form of social control, but it also was a liberation of the individual from the obligation to toil all the time. These people were often on big estates and that sort of thing, but they were liberated from their obligations to work for those estates for these lengthy periods because of religious festivals. We've lost that. And if you look even back at more recent times, back in the 1950s, when one man could earn a salary adequate to provide his family with a home, with a car, their new car every 3 years or something like that. And you didn't see beggars on the streets. I moved to Ottawa back in the 1970s. There were no beggars on the streets. Today, there are beggars at every intersection. There are four beggars operating the different points of the intersection. And these are basically homeless people. It's a deterioration in society that is absolutely scandalous and totally inconsistent with the growing potentiality of society to provide material comfort for its citizens.
That's beautifully put.
I can mention too that there's an attack on language, and regarding these religious festivals, in the French language, the word chôme used to be to celebrate a religious festival. Today, it's been converted into something called chômage, which is unemployment, which is a total disaster. So this is another example of how language has been subverted. We know it's been subverted in English. It's a phenomenon that goes on in every culture.
That's well.
There
well
you go.
Put. Yeah, no, thank you for that, Robert. That's well put. Very important that the attack on us, for us to actually not be cohesive, is part of it is language, part of it is culture, the deconstruction of our, if you like, our Christian roots. These are all part of culture. It's part of how we built, how historically we built societies to be cohesive, to stay together. Your thoughts, Mark Anderson?
Yeah, cohesiveness is very important, and the lack of it is so much a result of this bad monetary system, of this monopoly of credit that surrounds us all. It drives people consciously or unconsciously out of their homelands, and they go seeking greener pastures in another country, let's say Guatemalans or Nicaraguans heading up through Mexico to come into Texas, where I'm at. In fact, I'm near the border, and I've been to the border a number of times and reported on it as a journalist. And although there are myriad things, human trafficking and other motivations that bring people against their will across the border, the main thing, the underlying thing, is this corrosive monetary system. And people in the Far East or the Middle East or Northern Africa are driven into Europe by wars, largely Western wars. And those wars are launched to keep this monopoly of credit alive so it doesn't fall in on itself. Or you have the sometimes deliberately created poverty in Central America, let's say, and then those people are driven out of economic desperation to seek greener pastures in America. And so people are brought together largely against their will, and they're angry, they're desperate, and they don't really want to give up their home culture, so they bring their home culture with them, which is understandable to a degree. But at some point, you have to have either less forced immigration or you have to have real assimilation where the people from other places that come to their new home, where they learn the constitution and they learn the customs and they assimilate. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you just have the clash of civilizations that Trilateral Commission people wrote about rather favorably, such as Samuel P. Huntington and other globalists that welcomed or at least tolerated this deliberately created clash of civilizations. Mm-hmm. So if we get the proper monetary and financial reforms in place and fix the defects, you wouldn't have so much of this forced migration, and you wouldn't have this clash of cultures, and then we wouldn't have to surrender our own just to accommodate the others. Yeah. So it's a cause and effect thing right down the chain.
Yeah, no, that's an interesting comment. Just this weekend, I was writing an article and reading articles about our immigration issues in Australia, and the fact that 100,000 students are currently overseas and are having trouble getting back because of this virus thing in China, and they're deferring the start of the year. The study year at the universities, 100,000 students. The fact is, this is the mechanism whereby we get 100,000 new migrants every year. It's actually through our universities, virtually automatic. If you do a degree in our universities, then you can apply for citizenship and get it. So it really is a challenge to the thinking community. Is this an acceptable policy, and is it not? And of course, because the major parties are both pursuing the same policy, the end result is a deconstruction, if you like, of the host culture, and of course they're left floundering. How did all this go wrong? When they think they're going to vote for one, they vote for the other to try and fix it, and of course the issue gets worse. Your thoughts, Wally Klink?
Yes, that's true, Arnie, and you know, this whole thing really does have a metaphysical cause. It's every society has to have some kind of a philosophical approach generally to how they think and live, mm-hmm. how they behave, how they produce, how they consume, and generally the style of life that they wish to pursue. Now, the problem here is that we have, as you mentioned, an incomprehensible situation of poverty amidst plenty. Now, if you think about that, it's a complete contradiction in terms. It is logically, it's unsound. It simply doesn't hold together. Mm-hmm. So from a social credit standpoint, and getting down to technical aspects of economics, mankind has developed from primitive times by gradual discovery of principles, techniques, which have increased his ability to free himself from the constraints of nature. We have been able to enrich our lives and to increase our wealth, if you want, the consumer's ability to experience life. Now, what we call in social credit, these are increments of association, and they have built up incrementally into what we call the cultural heritage. And we depend upon the cultural heritage more and more for our functioning in an economic sense. We refer to discussions or to discoveries and to developments in the past and build upon them. And that way we have increasing efficiencies that are built into the system, which releases the need for a given amount of human labor in respect of a given amount of output. So that efficiencies actually do reduce the need for human input, mm-hmm. which is a marvelous thing because it frees us for cultural activities. It frees us from anxiety and stress and strain. It frees us from the very wasteful activities that we go into to a large extent. We have millions of people running off to work every day down the highways, running back again, taking public transport. And I think we have to ask ourselves, why are we doing this?
Yeah.
Are we really doing it for a good purpose? Now, if to the extent that we're doing it merely to earn incomes, and I mean financial incomes, so that we can purchase what incidentally has produced in the past, we have to think about that very seriously, because if we're just engaging in activity merely to collect money so that we can produce things that we've already consumed, things we've already produced, yeah, then something doesn't sound as though it's being organized in a very rational way.
Yeah.
Because the money that we're earning today, we're not saving it so that we can access or purchase the goods which will come out in the future, the goods upon which we are currently working. We're using our current incomes to bypass production. Mm-hmm. And those incomes are being canceled because they go back to the system, to the producer, and he pays off his production loan to the bank, and the bank mm-hmm. cancels the money out of existence. It no yeah. longer exists.
Yeah.
Now, what do you do when these goods you're working on come out and you're faced with the problem of how to purchase them? You don't yeah. have the money, because the money that is the cost of them has been canceled in respect of previous consumption, mm-hmm. in respect of previous production. Mm. Now, this is a real problem. We've produced the goods, they're there. They're available for us, but we have a blockage. The blockage is in consumption, mm-hmm. not in production. It's in consumption.
That's right. That actually leads us, Wally, into the thought of, I know there's a discussion in North America each year. It's called the basic income guarantee discussion. And I know that social credit has got a distinctive other point of view. And I think that's very important that we clarify it, because what we're talking about is production that has already happened. And here we are working in order to buy something that is already there. And of course, there's an anomaly in the, if you like, the distribution, the ability to actually consume what's already there. So the basic income is an option. It's out there. But of course, the Douglas proposed national dividend is an entirely different concept. Do you want to take that up, Robert Klink?
Well, the Douglas proposal is designed to fill a gap between collective prices and collective incomes. So the basic income people always have the idea that they're going to award, $12,000 or something like that, as a minimum that everybody will be entitled to receive in society. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't even look at the issue of a deficiency of buying power that's inherent in the economic system. Mm. So it is, and also it's based on the concept of taxing the rich to distribute their money to the less fortunate. Mm-hmm. And that is just sort of a dialectical situation that causes friction within society. Mm-hmm. It's a class war, in effect, which is always the solution that the Orthodox people propose. But Douglas said there's a deficiency of purchasing power, and it should be made up by the issuance of new purchasing power, yep. fresh purchasing power, without debt, so that people can make full use of their productive potential to the extent they want, and not suffer with the burden of debt going on, growing and going on into the future. Mm-hmm. You know, it deals with problems of the time at a time, rather than trying to put them off forever. So what we have now is a situation where there is artificial austerity imposed on virtually every society. People are always wondering about whether we're going to have a recession or a depression. Personally, I think we're constantly in a depression, yeah. because we're not making full use of our productive capacity.
That's right. That's a very valid point, Robert, that we can't actually liquidate the price of production. We can't liquidate it so that the producer can actually pay his loans back to the bank. I mean, if you were on an island and you had a self-sustaining economy, who do you owe the money to? You owe it to yourself. So it needs to be liquidated. If you're producing something, you need to be able to resolve the cost of that production. And that should be by the prices being sufficiently returned back to pay any loans off. The community is the one that's mobilizing it. They're using the raw materials that actually correctly belong to that very community. Your thoughts, Mark Anderson?
Yeah, Wallace and Robert made some very salient points there. First, what Wallace said about this log jam where we have this deficiency of purchasing power and how we got to fill that gap. It's often called the gap. Mm-hmm. And that is the critical thing. That is the critical, missing link to fill. We've talked about the missing link in Darwinism. This is the real missing link. This is the one that matters. This is the one that's true. Mm. Once we fill that with, as they both referred to, debt-free money, and this is new money, mm-hmm. This is new credit that comes into being. It's not money referring to what Bob said. It's not robbing from the rich to give to the so-called poor. It's not class warfare. It's new credit to fill that gap between all the prices and debts out there and the relatively paltry purchasing power. Once that new credit is brought to bear, the new money, if you want to keep it simple, then so many things would heal so quickly and yeah. So many things would begin to make sense so rapidly. And I think the revolution spiritually and physically would be almost mind-boggling. And this is why the powers that be keep this under wraps. They don't want this kind of liberation. And to build on what Bob said, it's very important. The basic income thing, while it does have some similarities to social credit, and Oliver Hadorn, the author of Social Credit Economics, is very good at outlining that at his website, socred.org. Uh-huh. But the similarities, while they're there, they drop off when you consider that you have to rob Peter to pay Paul. You have to dip into the tax till to pay kind of an arbitrary sum of money to people to help shore up their incomes. The problem is that's kind of like prescribing medicine without a dosage. Social credit, we know we calculate what the national dividend should be that each person would receive regularly to fill the gap because we know the numbers. But with basic income, they're just winging it. Yeah. And they don't really know what the right amount is. So that's similar to a doctor prescribing medicine without a dosage. Oh, let's just see if 10 ounces will work. You know, we'll just throw the dart at the dartboard. Yeah. But so social credit provides measurement. It provides a way to know not only that we need to fill the gap with a dividend, but how much of a dividend. And that dividend would go up or down depending on how big the gap is. Mm-hmm. And that's proper. We know what the dosage is, quote unquote.
Yeah.
And this is why social credit is similar to basic income, but it transcends it because it answers the problems that basic income have. And I'll note that as a footnote, I'm supposed to take part May 21 through 24 mm-hmm. in Hamilton, Ontario, in a basic income conference. That's very tentative right now. And Oliver Hadorn would be there, among others. I don't know all the details yet, but I'll soon see what's going on with that. But it's very helpful today on this show, Arnie, to be able to sort this out and get my thoughts up to speed on this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, very, very important it is. And yes, I have got Oliver's books and I find them fascinating and very, very thorough. Especially his two smaller books, we actually advertise them on our website, front page, alor.org. You'll see four of Oliver's books are there. And they're well worth hunting for, having a look at, because it actually opens up your thinking. Economics is actually not a static thing. It's actually dynamic. And an illustration of my life experiences is that if I boil a kettle, one kettle, that's static. But if I'm continuously boiling, that's dynamic, continuously boiling. In industry, industry is continuously boiling. It's continuously manufacturing. And so the flow of production is continuously flowing, and the wages and dividends are continuously flowing. And this is how you have to actually look at prices. And so liquidating prices, liquidating the cost of production, needs to be, again, be a flow, not static. It needs to actually be measurable. Very, very important that it is measurable. And of course, the statistics if you like, need to be available so that the community is aware that, okay, we need to do a new project, build a bridge or a building or fix a road or whatever. And then they know that, okay, these are the numbers, this is how much effort is going to take, and I need to make my contribution to it in the whole effort for the community so that it can actually be achieved, be realized. Very, very important. It's actually observable. And that to me is what science is about. It's observable, repeatable. Your thoughts, Wally Klink.
Yes, so historically, economics has taught that in the process of production, you generate costs and prices, but you do, but you also distribute incomes. And it has always been pictured as a circular thing where the incomes are equivalent to the costs and prices. That is true, but there's a lag, and the lag gets bigger and bigger as time goes on. Money that has been distributed but is already prematurely canceled, as happens in our economy, is not available as purchasing power. It may have been created and distributed, but if it's prematurely canceled, it's no help to the consumer, because the consumer can only use money that is in his hands and available for production. Mm-hmm. And you see, Douglas looked at economics as flows. You have a flow of costs and prices, and you have a flow of incomes. The two do not equate in time. Mm-hmm. In each cycle of production, your costs and prices are much greater than your incomes, for the simple reason that, as anyone should know, business has not only labor costs, which are incomes, but it has overheads in respect of capital and so on, the costs that are brought in from goods and services from a previous cycle. And those costs are allocated to prices. They don't distribute new incomes, they're just allocated to prices. And the more you modernize your economy, the more your costs become due to non-labor factors. And that means that the gap gets bigger and bigger. Every time you increase the efficiency through capital improvements, the financial system actually increases the gap between effective incomes and total price costs and prices. Mm-hmm. The financial system literally sabotages the efficiencies, the real efficiencies, the physical efficiencies that we make in developing our production system. And when we talk about paradise denied, you can see it right there. Mm. Our cultural heritage, which is our background in accumulated efficiencies, is sabotaged. And the benefits in terms of distribution on the widest level to the people in general, and the amount of leisure that we can have because of saved effort, is really quite enormous. And so in that sense, our cultural heritage has been appropriated by the financial system, and it has been stolen from us, so that we are just on a treadmill, constantly trying to liquidate fictitious debts. If you think about production, it's, forget about money, it doesn't exist. You're only thinking about things, energy being applied to materials. And Douglas was an engineer, so he was quite familiar with that type of process. He thought in those terms. Mm-hmm. He realized that the real cost of production is consumption. And the real cost of production is met as production takes place on a physical level.
Yeah.
There should be no residuum of consumer debt, because the physical costs have already been paid.
That's right. Looking at the natural world, the national dividend and the consumer price discount. Robert, could you just work us through the thinking in that in order to liquidate and find the financial system can be placed in equilibrium?
Well, the discount proposal is a reflection of Douglas's proposition. It's not a proposition, it's a statement of fact that the true cost of production is consumption, and therefore he proposed that because consumption is continuously going down in any productive program, you have to have a filling of the gap. And he said that this could be accomplished by discounting prices to producers would charge for their products, and that something like a national credit authority could issue credit to the companies discounting the prices, so the public could actually buy fully their production. Mm-hmm. They could fill that gap with a fresh credit. But he also recognized that this wouldn't solve the problem of the needs of the individual for income. Mm-hmm. And therefore, he proposed that a portion of that filling of the gap between collective prices and collective incomes should be paid in the form of dividends. And these dividends, in the nature of things, would be constantly increasing because efficiency is continuously going up. It's an astonishing thing that we have efficiency increasing at the same time as you have this phenomenon of price inflation, because it is exactly the opposite of what should be happening.
Yeah.
If consumption is continuously going down because of improvements in productive process, then unless the prices are going down too, you have an unrealistic, you have no reflection, in fact, of the reality of what the real processes of the economy. Mm. So, in fact, prices should be tending, prices in measured in money, should be continuously tending downward. Mm-hmm. Because if the financial system was reflecting reality, that would be the case.
Yeah.
In any case, Douglas proposed these two measures, the price discount, consumer price discount, and a national dividend that would be paid on an equal basis to all citizens as a representation of their share in the cultural heritage of society.
Yeah, no, that's fascinating explanation. Thank you for that, Robert. I do note that it's 100 years this year since Douglas's first book, Economic Democracy, went into print. 100 years this year, and I'm fortunate, believe it or not, I actually have a copy that has his signature on it. And I was fortunate to receive that for, not personally, but at least as a custodian of it. So I'm absolutely thrilled. Economic democracy. In other words, placing financial voting power into the hands of the individual. No different than political democracy, that each person has their own vote and it's up to them how they exercise it. The function of government is to provide an environment where the individual can exercise their freedom, exercise their choices, and make their own paradise, make their own heaven on earth. That's what the purpose of government is about. It's not to dictate. It's not to be authoritarian. It is to serve. It is to uphold the law and provide the environment for the individual to find expression in their own life. There is no other justification for government. Now, I do note we're at the 33-minute mark. I've found this really, really enjoyable, today's forum, and I will ask for final thoughts and closing comments. Mark Anderson.
Thanks, Arnie. Great show. Great to be on for the first time. Yeah, the paradise thing. What's interesting is, in my opinion, the paradise, if you want to use that word, the, you know, vastly more free society and more relaxed society that we would live in, mm-hmm. with the proper introduction of social credit, it would be both a personal and a universal paradise, both societal and individual. I don't think there's any dichotomy there. And it would create much more spirituality. The transcendent parts of Christianity would actually take on more meaning as we get the organic part in order, as we get our organic society in order. Many more people would come to the Christian faith because they would see more credibility in it. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of the Christian leaders, both Catholic and Protestant, need to wake up on this and need to look at this more closely. If they want to have more souls for heaven, they need to have a better organic, earthly application of Christian principles in our everyday life. And so this paradise that would be found rather than denied would be for everyone at all levels, both societal and individual. What a wonderful world it would be. Yes. And this is what we need to see. We need to see not only not only the obstacles, excuse me, but the ideals, the good part of this, and preach the gospel, so to speak, but only in this organic realm as well. Mm-hmm. And that's very important. And so hopefully this is what will happen, and we'll strive for what can be ours, and realize it's within our reach.
Beautifully put. Thank you so much, Mark Anderson. Closing comments and thoughts, Wally Klink.
Well, I certainly second what Mark has very eloquently said. We certainly do have to. I think we have to take a second look at Christianity. A lot of people who consider themselves to be Christians are great advocates, judgmental advocates of work. Work seems to be the primary thing. Responsibility and work, continuous work, seems to be the primary thing in their mind. Well, the idea of Christianity is salvation through grace. Mm-hmm. Grace is a gift. Salvation through works is what leads us to just enormous waste, wars, because wars are a very effective way of distributing incomes. And that's why in the West here, our economies are largely, significantly based upon continuous war. Mm. Now, this certainly can't be regarded as a Christian objective. So I think we have to take a second look. People like to talk about Paul when he said, you don't work, you don't eat. But Paul was speaking in very primitive times, in very specific conditions. And he was an old Pharisee. Maybe there was a little bit of a holdover from his previous convictions. But in any case, that's not what applies today. We have absolutely super capabilities in production. And the producer cannot consume what he produces, because he produces far more than he could possibly consume. So there has to be a mechanism of a distribution. In a mass production system, you have to have a mass distribution system. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it gets choked up at the point of consumption. And when that happens, that in turn has its effect on the producer, because a producer will not and cannot produce if he can't sell. Mm-hmm. So if there's something wrong at the consumption end, it has to be fixed. And that is what social credit from a technical standpoint is talking about.
Yeah.
And so I'd just like to make that point. And the compensated price also has, as Douglas said, there's not much point in paying a dividend if it's just going to allow prices to absorb that by moving upward. We have to make the price system self-liquidating, so that it actually, the problem is not being able to liquidate the cost of production. Orthodox economics seems to operate in a airy-fairy environment out there where prices are just free to go anywhere they want, and there's no reference to cost liquidation in the sense that we mean it. Because if you cannot possibly operate your economy in a way that doesn't liquidate costs, and that is where the emphasis has got to be made, not on prices varying according to a quantity of money. Mm-hmm. There is competition at the base level where you take out contracts, and people will contract to provide services. There's competition there. But at the final stage of the economic cycle in consumption, there has to be an equation, a meaningful equation and an effective equation of incomes with prices.
Thank you. That was very well, and to clarify those points. Thank you, Wally. Closing comments and thoughts, Robert Klink.
Well, I think about young people of today and the students and the terrible betrayal of them that has happened with these tremendous education debts they're burdened with when they graduate from university. they haven't a clue that back when I was in university, my annual my annual fees were something like $350 a session. And when I graduated from university, I had no particular difficulty in coming out with no debt whatsoever. Today, these young people are so terribly burdened, and they just don't have a vision of any other way, because it's what they're told is a normal situation. It's not a normal situation. And I just wish that they could get a glimpse of what social creditors are talking about, and a vision for the future that would give them a hope and the impetus to repair this defective financial system that we're burdened with.
Beautifully put. Lovely, lovely vision. Thank you so much, gentlemen, for today. It's been an excellent forum. I have really, really enjoyed it, especially our welcome guest, and hopefully come again, Mark Anderson. Thank you so much. Wally Klink and Robert Klink. This is Arnie Lurks at the Crossroads. Thanks very much.
Yes, Arnie, thank you. And it's been a delight to have our guest, Mark Anderson, with us today for the first time.
Great. Thanks, guys.
Another part of the world.
Great. All right. Cheers, then.